This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Saturday, April 13th, 2024. I'm Jared Halpern. President Biden strengthens defense partnerships in the Pacific with a Chinese threat looming.
The United States defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad.
And no jury duty yet for U.S. senators after the House holds off on sending over articles of impeachment.
You know, this is loaded with politics and loaded with gamesmanship.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. A great deal of world history will be written in the Indo-Pacific over the coming years, President Biden said this week, meeting here at the White House for the first ever trilateral summit with the leaders of Japan and the Philippines.
Today, we commit to writing that story in the future together.
Thursday's summit followed a lavish state dinner a day earlier in honor of Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio. And while the Biden administration says these relationships are enhancing economic, commercial, and innovative links, a lot of what happened this week was about deepening military cooperation in a not-so-subtle signal to China.
And I want to be clear, the United States defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad. They're ironclad. As I said before, any attack on Philippine aircraft, vessels, or armed forces in the South China Sea would invoke our mutual defense treaty.
The state visit for Japan was the fifth state dinner hosted by President Biden. All but one have honored Indo-Pacific leaders from India, Australia, and South Korea. Ian Brimmer is the founder and president of Eurasia Group. He says while the defense partnerships are certainly a big part of these alliances, there's also a lot of economic upside for the Biden administration.
These are critical allies of the United States. The geopolitics are very oriented towards the U.S. Biden's had some big successes there. You've got the Quad with India, soon to be the third largest economy within the next few years, much more aligned with the U.S. than it has been historically, and with a very strong leader in charge about to win an election. You've got the Japan-South Korea breakthrough, probably the most important win geopolitically and diplomatically that Biden has had on the foreign stage, kind of the equivalent of the Abraham Accords for Trump. Anywhere you look outside of China, you've got a whole bunch of countries that want to work more closely with the United States. And when you think about how badly geopolitics have gone with the war in Russia and Ukraine and the war in the Middle East, this is a part of the world that the Americans are doing pretty well.
I think you're right about the economy, right? These are big economies and there's a lot of commerce to be done. But the top portion of so many of these meetings deals with mutual security agreements, whether it's having now more interoperability with Japan joining this Australian network of missile defense and naval exercises with the Philippines. How do you view these? Are we sort of forming a NATO light or something in Asia, in the Pacific?
Yes. And indeed, if you look at NATO, the actual NATO itself, you have increasingly South Korean, Japanese, Australian leaders are coming at the highest level in sort of a observer format because they want to connect with the U.S. and the West. The United States, of course, is the only country that can project military power globally. And America's allies in Asia are really worried that they see a growing assertive China that wants to change the nature of the rules, and especially on security issues, is encroaching. It's encroaching in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea, on Taiwan, of course, and all of these kind of on the border directly between China and India. And these are all countries that want greater assurances from the United States. And there are also countries that aren't quite as worried because they're spending money on their defense too. They're building up their military as well. It's not like Europe that for 30 years said, we have a peace dividend, we don't need to pay attention to our defense. Countries in Asia know that they need to spend a lot of money and pay attention to their defense. This isn't new for them.
As you kind of look at that military component in these alliances, I know this week President Biden said this is purely defensive. This is not aimed at anybody. This is not about conflict. Is this reducing the likelihood of conflict in that part of the world?
I think it reduces the likelihood in the near term that China will act in an opportunistic and aggressive way. I mean, you know, the United States is building their military coordination with Australia. You talked about that already with Japan right now. The new submarine agreement, close missile defense, quantum computing, other things. The Chinese just decided to allow in spiny lobsters and Australian Shiraz into China. Doesn't make many headlines in the U.S., but they had cut off those imports. And the reason they did it is because they recognized that they were acting too aggressively. And if the U.S. is building stronger military alliances with these countries, China has to find a way not to make them feel like they're the big bully. Now, some of that is a response to successful U.S. multilateral policy with its allies all over Asia. Some of it is because the Chinese economy is also really underperforming right now, and they're worried about that. So, I mean, there is a question, what happens if the Chinese economy starts taking off? They start spending a lot more money across the region. Even if the U.S. security is working pretty well, will the Chinese become more assertive and more aggressive again? I hope we don't have to run that experiment, but it's an open question.
Well, you kind of answered the question I was going to ask, which is how do you see China countering some of this American influence, countering some of these new alliances? Is it closer, a closer relationship with Russia? Is it a closer relationship with North Korea?
Well, in the near term, it's a charm offensive with the West.
Okay.
It is, you know, 2 hours of meetings with 17 U.S. CEOs just a week ago directly right. with Xi Jinping. It is, you know, freezing all of the companies that were exporting precursor chemicals to create fentanyl in the U.S. It's more engagement with, you know, at the ministerial level with Yellen, the Secretary of Treasury, and even directly with the U.S. Secretary of Defense, which they weren't doing before. It's also reaching out to the business communities and high-level political leaders in countries like the Philippines and Australia and even Japan and South Korea that they weren't before. So that is happening, and it's happening even though the Americans haven't particularly given away the store. It's not like Biden has reduced some of the tariffs that Trump put on. He hasn't at all. In fact, there are more export controls. It's tougher on semiconductors, for example, on critical minerals, on electric vehicles. But your point, your question does, of course, also raise the issue that, well, what happens if the world continues to get more geopolitically aligned against China? Like, where does China go? Mm-hmm. And some of the answer for that, of course, is that they need a stronger relationship with Russia. They can't afford for the Russians to go down vis-a-vis Ukraine. And that has led to a lot more trade between the Russians and the Chinese in the last 2 years since the war started.
How does North Korea sort of play into this threat matrix? I did not know until listening to the news conference with the Japanese prime minister that he had expressed an openness to having some dialogue directly with North Korean leadership. President Biden said he would welcome that kind of exchange. Is that a likely outcome? Is that something that could actually happen?
Look, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think more diplomacy is useful. I welcomed Trump meeting directly with Kim Jong-un. And even though there wasn't a lot of diplomatic preparation for that meeting, there was a productive outcome, the so-called freeze for freeze, which was never formalized, But the North Koreans froze their missile testing, and the Americans froze the military exercises with South Korea. The South Koreans found out about that on CNN as opposed to from the U.S., but it was still a productive outcome. And now, I mean, you've got the North Koreans testing a lot more and the Americans freezing them out and not engaging at a high level diplomatically. And I think that's a mistake of the Biden administration. The fact that Kishida, the Japanese prime minister, wants to do that, I think should be welcomed by the Americans. And I'm glad that it has been. You know, where else do we go beyond here? Look, the Russians have built a much better relationship with North Korea, much better. They've gotten, you know, thousands and thousands of shipping containers of stuff, and we don't know what's in it from the North Koreans, but clearly including millions of rounds of ammunition. And those containers have gone back to North Korea, and they're not empty. And the North Koreans are clearly having help with their technology, their advanced technology, including space and missile technology from the Russians. And so much so that the Chinese are worried about it. I mean, the Russians are meeting with Kim Jong-un at the highest levels. We just had the foreign minister make a trip to North Korea. The Chinese are not engaging at the highest levels. They're engaging at the Politburo level. And they found out about Kim Jong-un's trip to Vladivostok to meet with Putin a few months ago. They found out about that when he was traveling. They didn't hear about it from the North Koreans directly or the Russians. So, I mean, this is a concern. North Korea is, you know, a hard ally to contain. And they've embarrassed the Chinese in the past. The Chinese are not looking for a sudden crisis on their border. They want more stability. The Russians are the chaos actors.
So does that present an opportunity then for President Biden and President Xi? I mean, something clearly both of them would be concerned about would be a hard to predict kind of erratic North Korea, no?
Yes, it does, but don't overstate it, because these countries, even though they want more stability in their relationship, they don't trust each other. And they're still fighting over Taiwan and over the second Thomas Shoal in the Philippines, which is quite dangerous. And they're fighting over technology, advanced technology, and that's not going to go away. So I do think it would be constructive. The Americans have done a lot of back channeling with China on messages to deliver to Iran. On why it would be really dangerous if the Iranians decided they were going to engage in direct strikes against the U.S. or against Israel. China's been helpful there. I think it would be useful if you had some of that with North Korea, but it will only go so far, because at the end of the day, there isn't a lot of trust between these two countries.
Let me finish with this, because, you know, you mentioned like the Abraham Accords, some of these other international pacts. You know, the Abraham Accords is certainly something that has been sustainable, has survived from one administration to the next. Are these types of alliances in the Pacific, in the Indo-Pacific region, built to last? In other words, does it matter who's the president, who's the prime minister of various nations for these types of agreements to hold and really kind of be, I guess my earlier point, kind of a NATO-lite type of alliance?
Yeah, I think that it certainly matters who the U.S. president is, but it's not dispositive. I think if you talk to Modi, he feels like he has a very strong working relationship with Biden and with Trump, and he really doesn't care who wins. It doesn't matter him at all, geostrategically, doesn't matter. He feels like his relationship with the U.S. is going to get much stronger. The Japanese are scared of a Trump victory. They felt like Abe was able to manage Trump reasonably well, but they got hit hard on not spending enough on the military, hit hard on trade imbalances, and they never knew what Trump was going to say, you know, until he showed up on the day. And so they had a hard time managing it. And they know that Kishida, who's good at foreign policy, but is not the same sort of strong leader that Abe was. And Abe's been assassinated, so he doesn't even have him as an informal advisor. They worry about that. The South Koreans are more worried. Their trade deficit with the U.S. is much, they run a much bigger trade surplus, and it has expanded dramatically, like 4x, since Biden became president. And you know, Trump pushed them hard on how much they are willing to spend for the American troops to be on the ground in South Korea. So that relationship could get a lot worse. And the South Korean president has just had a very negative parliamentary election where the opposition is in strong majority. And so he's a bit of a lame duck with no elections coming up for 3 years. So they're very worried. And I would say the Southeast Asians, like the Philippines, for example, Singapore, they're close to the U.S. They're in between. They're not panicking, but they're concerned.
Do you think the Chinese care who wins the election?
I do. They're still fighting about it, right? I mean, I think on balance, the Chinese, because they want more stability, because they don't want chaos, they're worried about Trump more. And certainly they're worried about what it would mean if a 60% across the board tariff on Chinese exports to the U.S. were to come into place. And not only that, but also hitting the Mexicans and others that are facilitating Chinese investment to pass through goods cheaper into the U.S. through third parties. They're very worried about that. They think the Trump relationship would be more dangerous for them. But they also know that if Trump becomes president, there'll be more pressure on other alliances around the world, like we just talked about, like with South Korea, like with the Europeans. Does that maybe create an opportunity for the Chinese to get some of those countries more on board and aligned with them? There are some on the military side that see Trump as an opportunity. But on balance, certainly with the high-level leaders that I speak with in China, more on the diplomatic and the economic side, all the way up to the Politburo, they recognize that Trump is they don't feel lucky. Let's put it that way. This is not a time that they want to be rolling the dice.
That certainly, I think, is something that is being debated in this country as well.
Of course.
Listen, these relationships, these alliances are very important. I appreciate you taking some time to kind of put them into a better context and kind of understand what the big picture here is for the Biden administration and for so many of these other leaders around the world. Ian Bremmer, always appreciate our chats. Thank you very much.
Yeah, happy to join you.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Have you ever had trouble getting a group together for, say, a meeting or an evening out? It's hard to get schedules to sync up, right? Make sure everyone is on the same page at the same time. That's an overly simple explanation for why a Senate trial for Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas did not happen this week. Recall, the Republican-led House impeached Mayorkas back in February, but a couple of recesses and the need to pass a spending bill to keep government open kept House Speaker Mike Johnson from formally transmitting those articles to the Senate. He had planned to do that Wednesday, but held off, delaying that move until at least next week at the request of several Republican senators. Political strategy is a big reason for that delay. Republicans are trying to mount a pressure campaign against Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who is widely believed to try to quickly dispense with the articles without a full-fledged trial that Republicans seek. Schumer has been coy about exactly how that trial could play out, but has dismissed the impeachment as purely political, saying earlier this week Democrats will try to resolve the issue quickly and an impeachment should not be used to settle policy disagreements. As always, Fox News senior congressional correspondent Chad Pergram helped break a lot of these updates throughout the week, even knowing a timeline before House impeachment managers. So he explained where the process stands and how it could play a role in the future of House Speaker Mike Johnson.
The idea that the House impeaches and then it is their decision about when they send the articles of impeachment to the Senate. But the Senate has to kind of, you know, say, OK, we're ready to receive. And it's kind of like a kickoff in football. And you look at the referee and he always points down at the other end and the guy standing back at the goal line waves his hand. So Schumer had not waved his hand yet. And the reason was because offstage they were discussing about let's get through this round of spending bills. You know, they had the minibus, the first one, the smaller one dealt with about 30% of all federal spending. And then they had a bigger one that they had to do, and they avoided, with the exception of about 2 hours, a government shutdown on both scores. So they had to get that done, got it done. That prevented them having a government shutdown and kind of cleared the decks. And the general agreement was, okay, we'll send that over then to the Senate. Well, Mike Johnson, in late March, March 28th, put out this statement saying, okay, we're going to transmit these articles this past week. And then Schumer immediately had indicated that the next day they would swear in the senators as jurors. And he has been very coy and played his cards very close to his vest as to what his next steps would be, you know, whether they would have a motion to table or a motion to dismiss or what he would do. And the reason Chuck Schumer really hasn't said much in detail is that he hasn't had to, because the articles have not been sent yet. And this was what was ironic, is you had, these conservative senators saying, wait a minute, out of the middle of nowhere, saying, no, we want more time to try to milk this a little bit. And there's some reasons why they want to try to milk this. In fact, I reached out when we heard about this to multiple House impeachment managers. These are the members, House members, who will prosecute the case before the Senate. And none of them had heard. In fact, one got back with me mistakenly, saying, Chad Pergram is reporting this, what do you say? Meaning, asking somebody in leadership or somebody else if this was true. They didn't know. I find that astonishing. And Mike Johnson kind of, kowtowed to the Senate conservatives and said, okay, let's milk this a bit. Because the presumption, although Chuck Schumer hasn't said this, and it was interesting that you had some of these conservative senators saying, oh, Chuck Schumer has said he's going to kill this right away. He has never said that. He has said we will deal with it quickly or something like that.
A couple of points to that. And one, I'm not surprised at all that you know information that House leadership doesn't, because you're so well sourced, maybe even better sourced than members of House leadership. But at any rate, we've talked about this on this podcast before. There is a handbook, a rule book on how the Senate handles impeachment trials. It dates back decades. It's been amended and updated throughout the years. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is that rule says the day after the articles are transmitted, unless that day is a Sunday, you swear in.
Yep.
Yeah. And so the idea that Schumer would say that, well, we're going to swear in on Thursday, should have come to a surprise as nobody, right? That's what the rule book says.
He said that the day after Johnson made the formal public announcement that they were going to send them this past Wednesday.
In fact, there was one point
where I was told, and I'm talking like back in February, even before they impeached Mayorkas, that they thought they might try to do it all in one day. But obviously that was not even the plan when they got to the point of actually, you know, receiving these articles. The other thing, too, here is that, you know, this is loaded with politics and loaded with gamesmanship. And so what the Senate Republicans, these conservatives, are trying to do is, as I said earlier, milk this. Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, said yesterday, he said, I can't wait to get these over here because I want to vote to dismiss as quickly as possible, because he thought it was ridiculous. But he said, these guys just want to make these fester for a few days. Well, and then what they'll do, if Chuck Schumer doesn't agree to certain demands, they are threatening to basically shut down the Senate and not agree to any unanimous consent requests. A unanimous consent request in the Senate is what they do to make sure the business runs on time. You can approve very non-controversial bills, decide that you're going to meet at a certain time. A set of amendments or votes will happen another time. If you don't get unanimous consent on anything, well, you can't do much of anything. And so I pointed out that even if they were to try to drag the Senate to a halt, there's not a lot that they have to do. They might try to deal with renewing FISA in the next week or two here, because that's expiring. There might be a nomination or two that they have to deal with. But really, they might have to deal with an altered Ukraine bill if it comes back from the House. But the House can't even get that aligned right now. Other than that, they don't have a lot that they have to do until they have to fund the government in September. So Chuck Schumer might say, OK, great, go to the mat. By rule, the Senate can come in every day at noon, including Saturdays. I mean, that's a standing order that they have.
Right.
And so they can just
Sunday's
say, OK,
the only day they don't come in. Yeah. And
that's right. We
like
could
just it's always like at noon or 1 p.m. Right.
No, the standing order in the Senate is noon, is noon, with the exception of Sundays. But the other thing is, as one source put it to me, they said if they do this, if Schumer doesn't agree to their demands to stretch this out and have amendments and votes and all these other types of things, they said, well, what we'll do, they said this is akin to what Tommy Tuberville, the Republican senator from Alabama, did, where he held up these military promotions for months of non-controversial military, very standard things that they do around here, and then just one day relented and got nothing out of it. So they might do that, but that doesn't really help impress upon the public the problems that the GOP sees with the border. Oh, they can talk about that, and they'll certainly get probably another news cycle or two out of this in the coming days until the impeachment trial formally starts. But beyond that, even if they go to the mat, that doesn't really probably achieve that much politically. It sounds like a great threat. It doesn't probably do that much, though,
well,
frankly.
And let me ask you kind of about what their complaints are, right? Their complaints are that they'll be sworn in as jurors, and then there'll be a motion, like you said, to either table this or dismiss the charges altogether. Mm-hmm. That is not unusual in an impeachment trial, right? There were preliminary votes in both of the Trump ones. I think one was about the constitutionality. The first one, there was a vote
yes.
to dismiss. Like those votes
there,
happen.
There was a motion. There was
those
a motion
votes happen
dismiss.
All the time, don't they?
We've only had about 20 some odd impeachment trials.
I guess I don't want to say all the time. You're right. These are rare events.
Right.
But in the universe of impeachments,
yes,
they're
precisely.
Not unusual.
Rand Paul had a motion to dismiss, which was voted upon and defeated in the first mm-hmm. President Trump trial. Let's go back to 1999 with the Clinton impeachment trial. Robert Byrd, the legendary West Virginia senator, former majority leader, he had a motion to dismiss as well. So that's not that rare, and that's within the parameters. Now, what they could do and could ask for is say, okay, let's have a set of guidelines here, okay? What are we going to do? Are we going to consider witnesses, take additional testimony? You know, they could send this to a committee. They've done that before. That's fully within the rights of the Senate impeachment rules, which were rewritten, as you alluded to, back mm-hmm. in 1983. So, you know, that's all possible. But, you know, much beyond that, I mean, Schumer, here's the problem for Mike Lee and some of these other conservatives is that the floor, the senators don't talk. They don't debate. They have to debate in private. They can do that. The impeachment managers and the whoever the defense counsel is for Mayorkas, they're the only ones who speak. But when you get to these amendments, it works much like the regular Senate does. And what do I mean by that? Well, in the Senate Majority Leader has the right of recognition first. So Patty Murray, who is the Senate President pro tem and will preside over this trial, usually the Chief Justice of the United States only presides if it involves the President or the Vice President, although you had Patrick Leahy, the former senator from Vermont, who was President pro tem, presiding over the second Trump impeachment trial.
Because he was out of office.
That's right. He was still in office at that stage. He was still in office at that stage. That's right. But he's gone now. He retired. But she didn't have John Roberts, the Chief Justice, preside. But she could rule and say, no, Mike.
Oh, no, I meant President Trump was out of office, which
yes,
is why
exactly.
the Chief Justice.
Exactly.
Yeah, my apologies. Yeah,
exactly,
the Chief Justice did not preside over the second Trump impeachment trial because he wasn't president anymore.
Right, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So bottom line is here is that she would recognize Chuck Schumer, which is how you do things in the Senate. And then Mike Lee might, you know, call a fast press conference upstairs in the radio TV
sure.
gallery to complain, oh, how dare they? They didn't recognize us, and this shows abuse of the system, and they don't take the border seriously, and they don't think that Alejandro Mayorkas has done wrong. So, you know, those are basically
Here's
the three or four talking
the
points.
The question,
that
though, is if there were to be a vote to dismiss or table or whatever sort of tool they use to kind of quickly dispense with mm-hmm. this, are Republicans confident that their whole side's going to vote no? I mean, we've heard from some Republican senators who have kind of raised eyebrows about, I don't know if this is a high crime or misdemeanor, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is where Tom Tillis, the Republican senator from North Carolina, said that he thought that maybe the process of impeachment has been cheapened. And therefore, it's something that, you know, just because he's a Republican, he's not necessarily going to vote to convict. So, you know, and this is where you have some Democratic senators or maybe attendance issues, frankly, where you have, you know, it's only a 51-49 majority.
Right.
And if you have the wrong set of people there, Chuck Schumer can just not dismiss this right away. You know, that's a problem. So this is where it's going to be tough votes for Democratic senators like John Tester of Montana,
sure.
Sherrod Brown, maybe Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, Jackie Rosen of Nevada, to take these very challenging votes.
What about Republican senators like Mitt Romney or Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, kind of the three or four House or since the three or four Senate Republicans we kind of talk about is kind of having their own independent streaks?
Right. Yeah. You see, and that's another interesting, you know, question. You know, Mitt Romney is retiring. You know, he was somebody who voted to convict in the impeachment trial of former President Trump, the first one. You know, certainly, I mean, he made a lot of news on that, speaking to Fox, actually, in an exclusive interview. So, I mean, you know, impeachment votes are different. You had somebody like Richard Burr, the former Republican senator from North Carolina, who voted to convict in the second impeachment trial. It's not always party line, and a lot of times people find reasons to vote that isn't exactly the way you think. I mean, look at the former the trial of former President Clinton. You had Arlen Specter, who at the time was a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, and they go around the room and they call the roll alphabetically, and they rise in their seats to ask, you know, guilty or innocent or whatever. And Arlen Specter, his oration at that point was not proven under Scottish law. I'm not quite sure I've heard that one before.
How was that recorded?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's basically a no, but that's if you read any news account of the day, that is in fact what Arlen Specter said. So, okay, read into that what you want. Not proven under Scottish law. I think I need a dram of Glenlivet with that. But okay,
that maybe that's what he was thinking. Maybe he needed a good strong drink after that. I don't know. So that's what we're going to be. We expected this. So if the articles come over, just to kind of put the bow on this part of the conversation, if the articles do in fact come over on Monday, we would expect this showdown, if you want to call it that, to happen on Tuesday.
Well, as of right now, we've not 110% heard that it's going to be Monday.
Okay.
Now, again, we think it's going to be Monday, but as you've seen, and as we discussed just a few minutes ago, that just because something is written in stone and coming from high-level sources like the Speaker doesn't always mean that it's going to happen that way. But the short answer is, if they do it early next week, they would probably do it late in the day. There's a bit of a ceremony. They walk the impeachment managers plus the articles over to the Senate. There's a procession escorted by the House Sergeant at Arms, Bill McFarland, the acting clerk of the House, Kevin McCumber. They're received by the Senate Sergeant at Arms. They present the articles. The next day, they swear in the jurors, and then you can do basically anything, and that's maybe when Chuck Schumer might try to dismiss, or Mike Lee might try to jump in and say, oh, no, we want to have some votes or amendments here.
So let's talk about the House, specifically Mike Johnson. He had this meeting with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has still kind of had this I've got impeachment on the brain, who has this motion to vacate kind of just sitting there, ready to pounce, I guess, at a time and place of her choosing. Any closer to kind of understanding her thinking, what it is she's looking for to prevent her from taking this step?
You know, not really. Because I did a pretty detailed interview with her on Tuesday afternoon, and she never really tipped her hand. I said, well, what is your trigger? And she said, well, I'm not there yet. And I said at one point during the interview, I said, do you know what your trigger is? And she really didn't have, expound on that. She met with House Speaker Mike Johnson late Wednesday morning. The meeting didn't go too hot, frankly, and she didn't give any more clarity there. The problem for Marjorie Taylor Greene is that she, you know, really probably in her heart of hearts wants to have a new speaker. The question is who, but right. I always say it's about the math. You know,
but that
she
didn't
does
stop,
not
that
have
didn't
the
stop
votes.
The group the last time. I mean,
that's
like,
right.
That was the case. What I'm trying to think, was it back in September, October when
October.
They had the vote against McCarthy? Is the question immediately was then who? And it took them 3 weeks to sort that out.
That's right. And she has not said a who. You think that again, with a narrow majority, I think that there are some Republicans who voted against Kevin McCarthy who might be willing to support him now. I mean, Nancy Mace, meaning Mike Johnson, Nancy Mace has been on our air. She was one of the eight who voted against McCarthy, really had kind of a personality conflict with McCarthy and has indicated that, you know, she has a better relationship with Mike Johnson, has been able to believes that he's an honest broker. You've had some Democrats signal that. But again, let's go back to the math here, Jared. It is such a narrow majority also in the House of Representatives that if she were to do this, and we'll underscore the word if you have the wrong or right, depending on how you look at it, number of people here, well, this could go sideways real fast. And you could suddenly elect Hakeem Jeffries. Now, Mike Johnson said on our air a couple of weeks ago, he said that's not going to happen, but you can't rule anything out because, again, everything in this institution, everything that you were told right now as to how something is going to work, it's almost like opposite day up here. If you're told A, I pretty much bet it's going to be B. So I don't know.
Let's kind of talk about like the bigger picture here then, which is, you know, obviously one of the big things that, that they're trying to get done is Ukraine aid, Israel aid, sort of the Senate package that also included some humanitarian relief for Gaza, for Palestinian civilians. Is that what decides whether or not Mike Johnson keeps the gavel?
I pressed green on that after her meeting with the speaker yesterday, on Wednesday. She wasn't clear about that. She is very opposed to putting a Ukraine aid bill on the floor. We'll see. I mean, again, anybody, you know, I asked Johnson, I asked Steve Scalise this week, I said, what is the path on Ukraine aid? Nobody seems to know. And then you have somebody like Brian Fitzpatrick, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who put together his own bill with some border security provisions, indicating to us that, yeah, there was going to be a bill next week. Now, how Mike Johnson politically gets out of this is he might have, you know, some of his members say, look, it's obvious you can't do this. We're going to sign up with the Democrats here. There's a parliamentary maneuver called a discharge petition. There's a way to go around the speaker, put this on the floor, and he can say, look, I didn't have anything to do with this. You guys all say, oh, let the House work its will. It worked its will. And there's a legal provision in this where they can go around the speaker. It doesn't happen very often. In fact, Mike Johnson might even prefer it to go down that way. It might be easier for the House because they can't say, well, you didn't block them from doing that. And frankly, I was told by one very senior Republican here, they said there's probably about 300 members of the House who would vote for Ukraine aid. Is it going to be more Democrats? Yes. You put Israel money in that. There's going to be some progressives, some Democrats who might not like that. So you have some attrition there, but you could pass a bill probably with 300 votes in the House of Representatives. The other provision here is that you have the three leading national security voices for the House Republicans. You have Mike Turner, the Intelligence Committee chairman from Ohio. You have Michael McCaul from Texas, who chairs the Foreign Affairs Committee. Then you also have, from Alabama, you have the committee chairman there as well, Mike Rogers, all for it. So they are the leading foreign policy voices, and I was told that they thought that these guys would prevail.
Also this week, we heard from the defense chief in Congress, right? So what was his message to lawmakers? I guess very much this money's urgent.
Yeah, but we've heard that for a long time now. And now people are starting to say, okay, the Senate passed its bill in February. It's been 2 months since the Senate passed that bill. At what point do they get that aid? And you talk to other Republicans up here, very conservative, say, well, you get this round of aid, and then is there going to have to be another one in the fall? Which the answer is probably yes. How do we define this? And this is where Warren Davidson, a Republican from Ohio, indicated to me the other day, he said, the administration has still not kind of said to us what the mission or what the parameters are. I mean, the mission is to, defeat Russia here. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of a way out. But yes, they made that case, but that case is not resonating with some of these other members who are just kind of dug in on that issue.
But no, so far we don't know when or if there'll be a vote.
And on what bill?
Right.
Nobody
Whether
knows.
It's the Senate bill or one of these other emerging kind of compromise bills.
That's exactly.
And if it is one of these emerging compromise bills, how does the Senate take that up?
Well, Mitch McConnell has counseled against this, but the Senate would probably just take whatever that the House passed and say, okay, be done with it. Which, Jared, brings us back to the impeachment trial. And this is really important because I was told that part of the machinations in stretching out the impeachment trial, think about the conservative Republicans who want to stretch out the impeachment trial. They mostly are opposed to aiding Ukraine. So if you jam up the Senate with a little more of a lengthy Senate trial dealing with Mayorkas, which is going to die, at some point, guess what? You have more trouble passing a House-passed Ukraine bill in the Senate. So if you look at the Machiavellian behind the hand here, that is some of what is going on. Yes, Ukraine aid has something to do with the impeachment of the Secretary of Homeland Security.
A lot to watch for next week. Chad Pergram, how's this for a promo? The man that congressional leaders go to to find out what's happening in Congress.
I like it. Thank you, Drew.
We'll talk soon, Chad. Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, deep dives into a couple of big issues this upcoming election. Jessica Rosenthal hears from experts on President Biden's student loan forgiveness plans and increasing difficulty for parents and students to even apply for new college loans. And those tax cuts passed by Congress in the early days of the Trump administration are set to expire next year as President Biden urges a tax rate overhaul for corporations and top income earners. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Jared Halpern. This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.